Open your Bibles, if you will, to Psalm 45. We will begin here in a moment as we look at, among other psalms tonight, Psalm 45, Psalm 2, Psalm 72, also Psalm 89 we will deal with. And we're going to see how these prepare us for Christ. So in just a moment, we'll focus on this. But let me, before we begin tonight, express my thanks to you all for this week. It has been a great blessing to be with you all, to worship with you all, to study the Bible with you all, to eat with you all. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your kindness. It is a blessing to eat with people like tonight. For every night it has, but tonight with Angie, who I was a student in school with just a few years ago. Angie and my wife was in school with Richard, and we were in school with David as well. And it's good. It was good to be with all of you in that respect. And it's been good to be with Steve and Donna. Sorry that she is not able to be out the last couple of weeks, but I have appreciated him and his family, his work for years. And it's good to be with him. God bless him in this regard. And Brian and Marie could not have been any more gracious. For those of you who are visiting, this may be news. For those of you who are here, you have followed this saga. But I left my suits I was going to wear in the place that I was last week. And what are the odds that you're going to stay with somebody with whom you are a perfect match in size? And so outside of the suit that Brother Glenn gave on Wednesday night, Brian has provided the clothing all week. He just told me to make sure that I don't pack that in my car when I leave tomorrow. But they could not have been more gracious. And I appreciate Brian and Marie very much. And God bless them. And it's been good to see all of their children this week, except for Annie and Jacob, who I had the blessing to have in college classes, and God bless them all. And it is so encouraging to see you who have visited so well. And it is, I appreciate Brother Adams coming out and making the journey to be with us tonight and worshiping with us. David Bobby, who attended where I preached years ago, over 30 years ago, has come a couple of nights. I appreciate that. And I have not seen Rick Moody, who may be new to some of you all, but in the back, he preached where I was in Florida, or attended where I preached in Florida. And it's good to see Rick. But it's good to see all of you all. I do want to say one more thing. So, It is very touching that Brian has had a cancer treatment today and is here tonight. There are different ways to teach. You can teach by getting up and explaining something. And you can teach by living something. And God bless you in that regard. Thank you for your example, Brian. And may God be with you as you continue that battle. I always feel inadequate in what I said. And I want to express my appreciation for every single one of you who've been here even once. But if we, by God's grace, make it to heaven, we'll have plenty of time to tell each other how we've helped each other along the way. And I hope to see you there. The psalms that we focus on tonight are royal psalms. Now, by that, I mean psalms that focus on the human key. And often words which are key in indicating something as a royal psalm are words like king, anointed, or David in the psalm itself. Now, the title, the name David is used in the title of 73 of the Psalms. And I think we should take those titles to the Psalms seriously. But I'm particularly talking about the body of the Psalm when I mention this. These are often indicators of a royal Psalm. And they are built on the promises of God to David in 2 Samuel 7. In 2 Samuel 7, David's conscience bothers him because he lives in better quarters than the Ark of the Covenant. And he says to Nathan that I want to build a house to the Lord. I want to build a temple for the Lord. And Nathan says, go and do all that is in your heart. But he hadn't inquired of the Lord before he said that. The Lord speaks to Nathan that night, and Nathan conveys to David the message, no, David, it is not going to be you who are going to build my house. Instead, I'm going to build up your house. And that word house is used in a different way. The word house in one case is used in the sense of a temple, a building, a structure. In the other case, it is used in the sense of a family. I'm going to build up your family. I'm going to, after you are dead, I'm going to raise up your sons after you to set upon your throne. He will build a house for my name. Speaking of Solomon, I will establish the throne of his kingdom. 2 Samuel 7, 13, verse 14. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rods of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But those promises to David are a key element in the Old Testament story. Now, let's look at Psalm 45 and let's look at some things that are said about the human king. Psalm 45 is a unique kind of psalm because in a certain way it is more addressed to the king than it is to God. But in Psalm 45, let's just begin with verse 1. My tongue overflows with a good theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and in your majesty. And in your majesty, ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome things. Your arrows are sharp. The peoples fall under you. Your arrows are in the heart of the king's enemy. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy above your fellows. All your garments are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. Out of the ivory palaces, stringed instruments have made you glad. King's daughters are among your noble ladies. At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir. Now, we're not going to give this all the attention that it's due. But what I want to emphasize is when they spoke of their king, they were speaking of their king in ideal terms. It is hard for us in our government to realize how much hope they placed in a king. The king was all the branches of government rolled up into one. He is described in Lamentations 4, verse 20, as the breath of our nostrils. But notice how he is described in verse 2. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. In order to be a king in the ancient Near East, you had to look the part. The Bible does not often talk about the looks of the main characters. If it talks about it, it's because it plays a part in the story. For example, in Judges 3, Eglon was a very heavy man. Well, that plays a part in the story. And often in the story of kings or people who wanted to be kings, there are references to their looks. For example, in 1 Samuel 9 and verse 2, Saul is described as a good-looking man and from his shoulders up, taller than any of the people. In 1 Samuel 16:12, when we're introduced to David, he is described as good-looking. Absalom made a bid for his father's throne, and there was no one so good-looking in all the land of Israel. 2 Samuel 14 and verse 25, Adonijah made a bid for David's throne at the end of his life, and he too is described as a good-looking man. 1 Kings 1, verses 5 and 6. Now, I know all of those verses may be a little bit of overkill, but I'm trying to stress the point that even though the Bible does not usually mention the looks of characters, it repeatedly mentions the looks of kings and people who would be kings. Because in order to be a king in the ancient Near East, you needed to look the part. The king was the best looking of men. But the king was also the mightiest and strongest of men. In verse 3, gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and in your majesty. In verse 5, your arrows are sharp. The people fall under you. Your arrows are in the heart of the king's enemies. The king's enemies are falling all around him because he has on his sword. He is riding forth in his splendor. The king is the best looking of men. The king is the mightiest and strongest of men. And the king fought for the most noble causes. Look at verse 4. In your majesty, ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Now, those of you who are my age and older, Superman television show, what does it say about Superman? He fought for truth, justice, and the American way. The point in describing Superman like that was to point out that he fought for valid reasons. He fought for valid causes. He used his power to bring down evil and to exalt good. And that is what is being said about the king. The king is the best looking man. The king is the mightiest and strongest of men. The king, as a man who fought for the best causes, a man who loved righteousness and hated iniquity. I graduated high school in Dixon County in Tennessee in 1981. Our class had 400 people. That may be the exact number, but if it's not the exact number, it was like 401 or 399. It was in that area. But in the class before me, there was a really unique circumstance that I did not appreciate at the time, but I have reflected upon over the years and thought about how unique this was. The person in the class before us, in this class of around 400 people, there was one person who was clearly the best athlete. And he got a college baseball scholarship. But he was clearly the best athlete, played every sport. He not only was the best athlete, but he had the highest grade point average. He was the smartest as well. I have never considered myself a good judge of these matters. But from listening to the girls talk, he was also regarded as the best looking in class. How often do you see all those qualities combined in one? Not very often, do you? When this pictures the king, it pictures him as the ideal person, as the one who was the best looking, the mightiest, and the most godly. And by the way, I want to add one more thing about that person. Though I do not know where they are today, they were a Christian. That person was a Christian who was baptized for remission of their sins and who attended church every Sunday night and Wednesday night. You just don't find that very often. But right now, what I want you to carry with you is this picture of a king as one who is all of these things. Now, I invite you to open your Bibles to Psalm 2. Psalm 2, as we look at this royal psalm, we want to read to verse 9. And we're particularly going to focus on verses 7 through 9. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast their cords away from us. Some psalms begin with questioning why, asking why circumstances are the way they are. Psalm 10 begins that way. Psalm 22 begins this way. This begins with a why, but this why is addressed to God by looking at the nations and seeing the nations in rebellion to God. And He says, why, God? Why are the nations in an uproar? Why are the people imagining of vain things? He cannot believe man's insane hostility against God. And you notice in verse 3 that all the nations and the kings and the rulers want to tear off these fetters and cast apart these cords. The point is, they think that service to God is slavery, and they don't want anything to do with it. If you think service to God is slavery, you try service to sin. And you will find out what real slavery is. That is slavery. It's God who sets us free. But in verse 4, he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. That he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. Verse 7. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Do you remember we mentioned 2 Samuel 7:14 a moment ago? I will be a father to him and he will be a son to me. God said of that king who is from the line of David. Here the text says, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. There was a father-son relationship between God and the king. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Look at verse 8. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. I will give you the nations as an inheritance, the ends of the earth as your possessions. Now I want to ask you a question. At what time in Israel's history, in Judah's history, did they exercise the kind of worldwide dominion that verses 8 and 9 speak about? At what point in their history did they exercise that worldwide dominion? Now, many people say, oh, you're talking about David and Solomon. David and Solomon was probably the closest that they ever came. But they were not the most powerful nation in the world the way that Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon were in his time. But I think Tim was catching on to the fact that there was never a time in Israel's history where they exercised this kind of worldwide dominion. Ask of me, and I'll give you the nations as your inheritance, and the ends of the earth as your possessions. And you will break them with a rod of iron. There was never a point in their history where they exercised that kind of dominion where they were the most powerful nation on earth. Now keep that in mind, okay? Right now, just keep that in mind. That father-son relationship between God and the king is also expressed in Psalm 89, verses 26 and 27, which we will look at in just a moment. But this universal dominion that the king has is also expressed in Psalm 72. If you look in Psalm 72, Psalm 72, verses 8 through 11, what we see is the same kind of picture as Psalm 2, verses 7 through 9. In Psalm 72, in verse 8, may he rule from sea to sea, from river to the ends of the earth. Let the nomads of the desert bow before him, and his enemies lick the dust. Let the kings of Tarshish and of the islands bring presents, and the kings of Sheba and Seba offer gifts. And let all the kings bow down before him, and all the nations serve him. So what we've seen so far about the king is that this king from the line of David, this king who is a son to God, and God is his father, he is going to exercise worldwide dominion. But also involved in Psalm 72, and Solomon's picture of this king, is he will do righteousness and justice. That term is used frequently in these Psalms. Look at verses 1 through 4. Give the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your afflicted with justice. Let the mountains bring peace to the people and the hills in righteousness. May he vindicate the afflicted of the people and save the children of the needy and crush the oppressor. Look at verse 12. Verse 12. For he will deliver the needy when he cries for help, the afflicted also, and him who has no helper. He will have compassion on the poor and the needy, and the lives of the needy he will save. He will rescue their life from oppression and violence, and their life will be precious in his sight. The kings of Judah and Israel are praised for their mercy, for their compassion, for their justice, for their righteousness. Now, this was not a given in the ancient world. In some of the monuments that the kings of Assyria recorded, they boasted of their brutality, and they boasted of those that they set upon fire, and boasted upon those they skinned alive. But that is not the way it is for God's kings. They are not going to rule simply seeking to oppress and mistreat others. They are going to have compassion on the needy and rescue everyone's life, all the weak and the poor and the needy. And I'll tell you a category we could add to that is the unborn. And their life is precious in a good ruler's sight. Now, let me ask you a question. After the kingdom divided, in the days that Jeroboam became king of Israel and Rehoboam became king of Judah, how many kings of Israel in the days of Jeroboam to the time of Hoshea in 2 Kings 17, how many of those kings of Israel did righteousness and did justice and cared for the poor and the needy? None of them. None of them. Let's go to Judah, where they had the temple, and when they had the priest from the tribe of Levi, like God stated, how many of those kings of Judah did righteousness and justice and cared for the poor and needy? There were a few, but they were the exception and not the rule. You had Asa, who was a good king. Jehoshaphat was a good king. Beginning with Joash, about 835 B.C., you have a string of four decent kings. But then you have, at the end, you have Hezekiah and Josiah, who were very good. But what I'm trying to tell you is even among God's people Israel, where they had all these special promises, the kings did not live up to this ideal. As you read these Psalms, and if you read the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, is what is said in Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles of the history of Israel, is it what we would expect from the royal Psalms? It's not. In one Psalm that makes that brutally obvious is Psalm 89. Psalm 89. Psalm 89, the words loving kindness and faithfulness will each be used seven times in this psalm, and they are a very key idea in this psalm. We stated earlier in the week that most of the psalms move from lament to praise. This psalm is different. This psalm moves from praise to lament. But 2 Samuel 7 is basically poetically retold in Psalm 89, beginning with verse 19. I don't want to read all of this, but let's read verses 24 through 27. 24 through 27. My faithfulness and my loving kindness will be with me. And in my name, his horn will be exalted. I will also set his hand on the sea and his right hand on the rivers. He will cry to me, you are my Father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. I will make him my firstborn, the highest of my kings the highest of the kings on the earth. My loving kindness I shall keep for him forever, and my covenant will be confirmed to him. Verses 24 through 28. God is going to make Judah's kings the highest of all the kings of the earth. Is that what happened? Is that what happened? Follow me as we talk about the last five kings of Judah. Okay? Talk about them very briefly. Josiah was the last good king of Judah, 640 to 609. He was a great king in many ways. But when he dies, he is killed by the king of Egypt because he's going up in battle to help the Assyrians against the Babylonians. To help the Babylonians against the Assyrians. But Josiah is killed by the king of Egypt. Does it sound like he is the most powerful of kings on the earth? Josiah is followed by his son, Jehoahaz, who only reigns 3 months. He reigns 3 months until Pharaoh Necho comes, removes Jehoahaz from the throne, takes him as a prisoner to Egypt. He never returns from his imprisonment in Egypt, and he sets Eliakim on the throne and changes his name to Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim in his life is besieged by the Babylonians who set all kinds of forces around the city of Jerusalem, though Jehoiakim seems to die a natural death. He is followed by 3 months, for 3 months, by his son, Jehoiachin. And Jehoiachin, after 3 months, goes out and surrenders to the Babylonians and is taken captive, and he never returns from there. And then Zedekiah is the last king that Judah ever has. And what happens to Zedekiah is Jeremiah tells him, go out, surrender to the Babylonians. He does not do it. As a result, he is captured. He is taken before Nebuchadnezzar. The last thing that Zedekiah ever sees are his sons killed right in front of his eyes, and then they put out his eyes. Why do I mention that? Because if we were living in that day and time, these promises of God that I will make my king the highest of the kings of the earth, it would have seemed like they failed. And that's what the writer is saying in verses 38 through 52. Look at verse 49. We stated the word loving kindness, the word faithfulness are key words in the Psalms, each mentioned 7 times. This is the last time each of these words are used. Where are your former loving kindnesses, O Lord, which you swore to David in your faithfulness? God has pictured a king who would be the strongest of men, the best looking of men, and the most godly of men. God has told him that he would be a son to God, and he would be his father, that he would exercise worldwide dominion, that he would be the highest of the kings of the earth, and that he would do justice and righteousness. And the story of Kings and Chronicles is a group of kings who do not live up to those expectations. Well, there are 2 options. Either God's promises failed, or there's still more to come. When the Old Testament ends, there is no king on the throne in Jerusalem. There is no descendant of David reigning. The people are subject to the Persians as the Old Testament ends. But you know what the first verse of the New Testament says? Jesus Christ, the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. Why mention that He's the Son of David? God made those promises to David. That one day you will sleep with your fathers, and I'll raise up your son upon your throne, and I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me, and he shall reign over the house forever. And Jesus is pictured from the first verse of the New Testament as the Son of David. What that tells us is that God's promises have not failed. God's promises are still being fulfilled in Jesus, it's telling us. And Jesus is the King that the Old Testament longed for. These Psalms are quoted frequently, and I only am mentioning this quickly, but each of these Psalms that we have covered tonight are quoted continually in the New Testament. Particularly Psalm 2 verse 7 is quoted at the baptism of Jesus, it's quoted at the transfiguration of Jesus, and it's quoted in Acts 13 verse 33, as is also written in the second Psalm, you are my son, today I have begotten you, and applied to the resurrection. Now understand, this list could be longer than this. But what I'm trying to tell you is it's very clear in the New Testament that God's promises have not failed. That God's promises have been fulfilled in this King, Jesus. Brian is going to make sure that all of you who want them have access to any of the PowerPoint that we have made this week. But in Matthew 2, wise men, magi, come from the east, and they say, where is he who is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and we have come to worship Him. Jesus is spoken of as King of the Jews in Matthew 2. Do you know that phrase, King of the Jews? It's not used again in the Gospel of Matthew until we get to Matthew 27 and verse 11. And Jesus is standing before the governor, Pilate. And Pilate asks Him, are you the King of the Jews? Let me encourage you to do what I'm about to suggest. I want you to take a concordance. Look at the time the word king is used in the New Testament and specifically applied to Jesus. And what you will find is that there are a heavy concentration of these passages that speak of the king, Jesus being king, that are focused around the cross. For example, in John 19, Pilate has written above Jesus' head in three languages, this is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Some of the Jewish leaders come to Pilate and say, do not say that He is the King of the Jews. Say that He said He is the King of the Jews. And Pilate said, what I have written, I have written. Pilate was unwillingly, unknowingly, proclaiming the truth about Jesus in three languages to everyone who passed by. This is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. All God's promises about the king in the Old Testament find their fulfillment in Him. In this one who is going to be the king, who is going to care for those who are the least. Do you remember how he gets up the night of his betrayal when the disciples are arguing about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom, and he girds himself with a towel and he begins to wash their feet. He is going to be a king who cares for the least. He is going to be a king who does justice and righteousness. And he was the mightiest of men. He was mightiest of men who could cleanse lepers with a touch, open the eyes of a blind, and raise the dead. Raise the dead. The only thing, in a certain way, Jesus doesn't mean is those statements about the appearance of a king. He has no form, nor comeliness, nor beauty that we should desire him. Jesus may not have been the best looking of man physically. He may not have looked the part of a king in the ancient of Near East. But he was the fulfillment of God's promises. These promises created a longing in their heart as they looked at their history, and they knew everything we're saying tonight. They knew their kings had not filled the bill, and they looked for one who would. One who would be a fulfillment. And remember how Jesus said, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and earth." He rules over all nations. All authority has been given to me in heaven and earth. Go therefore and teach all nations and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all things that I've commanded you. For lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the earth. His dominion goes from sea to sea, from the rivers to the end of the earth. He is king. Right now. Right now. But I want to tell you, there will be a day when every knee will bow to Him and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God. There will be no doubters that day. There will be no disputers. All will acknowledge Him as King. These statements about a king in the Old Testament, these statements about a king in the Psalms, created a longing, a desire in the hearts of people that was never fulfilled in Old Testament times, that led them to look for an anointed one, a Messiah, who would fulfill these words. And that king is Jesus. How have most kings throughout history lived? You remember in the book of Esther, a king by the name of Ahasuerus or Xerxes, and his wife doesn't do what he says, and so he divorces her. And he calls for all the beautiful young virgins in all the land to be brought to him so that he might find a replacement for the queen. After another period of time, he calls for another gathering of the virgins. You see, everybody in Persia was there to please the king. Jesus said, "I did not come to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many." Only this king is willing to die for his subjects. This is a king we can truly be convinced has our best interest at heart. That is a king to follow. He rules over all nations. If you have heard his word, and you know he died and rose again, be baptized. Repent and be baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Brother Steve and the brethren here and the elders here will be glad to help you as we stand and as we sing.